Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where good taste and bad taste explode.
Does that mean we have good, we no longer have good taste nor bad taste, we just have taste?
I think it's a metaphor.
Ah, of course, the metaphor defense.
Yes.
Introduce yourself, William.
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs, and I invented the metaphor defense.
No, that was the song MacArthur Park.
Oh.
I'll explain in a moment. My name is Whitney Seibold. Okay. I, too, am a critic. And Dave Barry once wrote a book about bad songs.
Ah, of which there is no shortage.
Well, he conducted a poll among his readers. Like, what is the worst pop song? And there were, like, pretty strict definitions to what constitutes a pop song. And MacArthur Park ran away with it. It was, like, handily the worst pop song ever written.
If you don't know the song MacArthur Park, wasn't it written and performed by Richard Harris?
I believe so.
Richard Harris, who's best known today as Dumbledore, the original Dumbledore before Michael Gambit and Jude Law. Listen to that fucking song. That's some... The lyric, "someone left the cake out in the rain," is given such a portentous reading.
And I don't think I can take it, because it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again.
I honestly have no idea.
The defenders of the song say, no, that's a metaphor. And to which Dave Barry said, okay, it's a metaphor. It's an incredibly stupid metaphor.
That's right. Well, for what?
Yeah.
Like, what are we talking about? It's a metaphor for that time I left my pie out in the rain.
The cake is really a pie.
there's actually the opening of that movie, Vertical Limit. Oh, with Chris O'Donnell, and it's a mountain climbing movie. Martin Campbell directed it.
Martin Campbell movie.
Yeah. The opening of Vertical Limit is actually a really harrowing opening.
It's a pretty good mountain climbing movie.
The movie's okay, but I think the opening is even better than the movie. It's just about a mountain climbing incident that goes horribly wrong. Not unlike Cliffhanger, but, you know, whatever. Mm. It's still thrilling. The movie opens with a father trying to explain to his two kids that, no, MacArthur Park is a real song. I didn't make that shit up. And it all leads to horrible death. So, that's why you come to Critically Acclaimed, to learn stuff like that.
We tie in the song MacArthur Park to the movie Vertical Limit, a movie you didn't even know about that movie, did you?
We haven't been on the air for 4 minutes yet, and we already pulled that shit on you.
So welcome. You're to welcome. Critically Acclaimed.
Yeah.
What are we reviewing this week?
This week we're reviewing the new releases, The Batman.
Not just a Batman.
Yeah. The horror movie Fresh. The sci-fi drama After Yang, and I guess it's a vigilante thriller called Asking for It?
Yeah, it's a vigilante revenge thriller.
Look, I didn't see that one, but Whitney did, so he'll be reviewing that.
I did. I rented it and watched it.
Now, my question for you, Whitney, and we did not discuss this before the show began, but I'm going to leave this entirely up to you.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about The Batman first, or do you want to talk about The Batman last?
Let's get The Batman out of the way.
Out of the way.
Following
your lead.
Usually we like to sort of tease it. It's like, let's talk about the big movie, and we mention the obscure one.
We could do, let's talk about a movie about vigilantes. Okay, here's Asking for It. Let's talk about the best Colin Farrell movie opening this week. Okay, it's After Yang. Let's talk about the best movie with a supervillain in it. Okay, that's Fresh.
Played by one of the actors from the Avengers movies.
That's true.
He plays bad guy in Fresh. No, The Batman is... the latest in a long string of Batman movies.
Yeah.
This one is very, very long. It's 3 hours in length.
Yeah.
It's directed by a fellow named Matt Reeves, who I guess has a bit of a following after the three Planet of the Apes films he made.
Oh, he made two Planet of the Apes movies, to be clear.
Oh, he didn't do all three.
No, he did. Rupert Wyatt did the first Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah.
He took over for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes.
I like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
I like Dawn a lot.
War of the Planet of the Apes, less so.
I think War of the Planet of the Apes never earns its portentousness.
It's really cold and intense and harrowing, and like
they kind of forget that it's fundamentally kind of silly.
This is an ape movie. Where's like
scale it back a smidge.
The metaphor for this, like the satire.
The metaphor is I saw Apocalypse Now once. Like, I've never been a fan of war, but I've rewatched it because everyone's like, you should try it. You should watch it again. You missed it. I'm like, okay, fine. I rewatched it. It's not. I don't think it's very good. I think it's one of those movies where its serious tone and grim imagery make it seem great, but I actually find it very kind of superficial. It's just brushing up against the big ideas without really exploring them very well. And it's okay, I guess. And, I just think it's very interesting.
Speaking of brushing up against grim imagery without having anything really important to say, let's talk about the Batman.
Oh, snap.
Hey, Sting.
We're gonna. By the way, and this is going to be frustrating for me because a lot of my problems with this movie, and I'm more mixed on this movie than Whitney is. There's stuff I like here, there's stuff I don't like, but... a lot of stuff I don't like goes into spoiler territory, so I'll try to allude to that without going into a lot of detail, which is going to be a little tricky, and I might need to edit it myself if I accidentally give away a spoiler. But basically, what we're doing here, when we review a movie that is as has so much hype behind it and so much anticipation.
Big high-profile movie.
The concern over spoilers is a little different than if we're reviewing something like After Yang, which a lot of people don't even know is out, and they're not going to be as tormented if we reveal something that happens 40 minutes in. So we're going to do the best we can to respect the movie, because it is a mystery.
Yeah.
It is structured as a mystery. We're going to respect the mystery. We're going to not ruin that, but we may have to allude to some things vaguely in order to make a coherent point. And maybe later on down the road, we might do a more in-depth talk about it if people want to talk about it on We've Got Mail or something. But for now, we'll try to do this relatively spoiler-free, but we will need to talk about some stuff in the movie, so fair warning.
So we're catching up with a new Batman. Mm-hmm. This is Robert Pattinson now plays Batman / Bruce Wayne. He's rarely Bruce Wayne. In fact, he's in every scene in the movie. This is a pretty straightforward single thread plot. It's not super complicated.
There's the opening murder, but like that's it. Everything else is Bruce Wayne. There's a
little bit, sort of convoluted a plot, but Batman is always there to witness it. Mm-hmm. There aren't any of those frustrating scenes where we have to wait for the character to catch up with something we already know.
That's true.
I appreciate that.
For a movie that's 3 hours long, there's not a lot of dilly dallying.
This is a rainy version of Gotham City. It looks a lot like sort of an industrial version of New York. Mm-hmm. It's
like New York crossed with like Detroit or something like that.
So it's all very, very miserable. It's always raining. I assume it's the Pacific Northwest.
It's usually supposed to. Gotham City was, Gotham was actually a term that was often used to describe New York City.
Prior to Batman.
Right. So the idea, which is where they got the idea of Gotham City from, is like a name. So it's usually supposed to be New York, depending on who's telling the story or how they decide to visualize it. Sometimes it's New Jersey. Sometimes Christopher Nolan decided it was Chicago, so he made it look more like Chicago. We have made the argument in our Batman podcast on Patreon, where we're reviewing every single episode of the 1960s Adam West series, that we're pretty sure that version of Batman is in Miami, Florida.
Yeah, it's definitely in Florida. It's a standard for Florida. This is a really sort of a grim, wet version of New York City, very akin to the New York you might have seen in a 1995 film called Seven.
Although Seven is not explicitly New York. The idea of Seven is supposed to be like any city.
Yeah, I understand.
They actually shot it in L.A.
It's New York. No, it could be L.A. as well. And it has there's a serial killer at large.
Yeah, his name is the Riddler. He's
calling himself the Riddler, and he's modeled very heavily after the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah, a lot of Zodiac Killer, a little bit of influence from the serial killer in Seven, a little bit of influence from Jigsaw. He's got some death traps.
The Batman is Seven. It's just Seven.
It's
Seven with Batman as an investigator. If that sounds interesting to you, hey, go have at it.
Well, I'm actually going to say this right now. I actually think that's... one of the more interesting sort of things I find about this version of Batman is the idea that we've reached this point. It is the year 2022. And the old-fashioned aesthetic we're going for, like when Tim Burton did Batman, he went for the aesthetic of...
silent movies.
German expressionism and sort of an industrial aesthetic. When Joel Schumacher did it, he was going for more of more of an Atlantic City 60s vibe. When Christopher Nolan did it, he went for more of a grounded Michael Mann vibe. And now Matt Reeves has taken over, and sure, bring your own aesthetic to it. And the aesthetic that he chose was...
David Fincher.
Seven is obviously a major touchstone, but I think he's taking as a sort of a visual gospel that whole post-Silence of the Lamb era of thrillers from the 90s, where things got pretty damn grim dark. And we're looking at stuff like, obviously Seven, as we mentioned, but something like 8mm, or Kiss the Girls, Copycat,
Double Jeopardy, those kinds of movies.
Exactly. Yeah. And honestly,
Bone Collector.
Maybe not so much Double Jeopardy, but like. But it's in there. I just don't think he was influenced by it. But,
Do you ever see the film Night Moves with Christopher Lambert?
You know, I've never seen all of it, but I know what you're talking about.
It's really, really similar to something. Yeah.
So, like, this idea of a sort of a pulp murder mystery kind of vibe it's interesting to me that we've reached a point now where that's, like, retro cool. Like, we've had so many movies that were fetishizing. We've had so many movies that were fetishizing the aesthetics of the 80s.
Yeah.
And now we've hit the... Like, the main theme of this movie, like, musical theme, is Something in the Way by Nirvana.
Mm.
They play it multiple times throughout the film. Like, well, that's interesting to me that that's considered, like, old school thriller now.
I think it's...
The good era.
That all makes sense given the age of the directors we're looking at.
Sure.
Because, you know, Matt Reeves is only a little bit older than we are, so he was, you know, in his 20s in the 90s.
Sure.
And that's sort of a lot of the influence he was growing up as a young man.
I just think that's of note, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually like that aesthetic. I think it's interesting that we're bringing it back.
I think it's sort of a way to try to gussy up something that's not terribly interesting, quite frankly. I feel about this way the same way I feel about Joker, the Todd Phillips movie, where they used a lot of very powerful aesthetics and good music and some pretty impressive performances.
Cinematography
and a lot of good
is great.
Costuming
all the
and cinematographer,
technicals in
yeah.
Joker are very impeccable.
And
yeah.
All to tell a story that at its heart is actually pretty pat. And not as complex as all of those aesthetics would have you believe. And I feel that way about this Batman film as well. Robert Pattinson is this Batman. He has just the worst dialogue, all of these really I am the knight kind of monologues.
Who are you? I am vengeance.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
I would go with Batman for you. I feel like you've got like a bat logo, you got the bat ears. Maybe you should try Batman instead of vengeance. No, I'm vengeance.
In a rather amusing twist, this version of Batman is just sort of welcome onto crime scenes.
So that's like, weird, right?
He's like in the bat suit and
so
is just sort of walking around with
the police
all these uniformed
like
cops.
The idea is the Riddler kills a guy at the beginning and it sets in motion a series of slayings, and every single one of them involves riddles that take Batman like deeper into the heart of some kind of conspiracy involving
cops
and organized crime
and
the mayor's office.
Really, really off the rack. Police and gangster
corruption. I mean, it's not a bad idea, but like it's not in and of itself. It's not unique. Although we really have, to be fair, we really haven't seen like the detective side of Batman in any of the live action movies before, except for like a couple of asides.
I think it's a big part of the Christopher Nolan movies.
A little bit, but it's not like this. This is played more like
this is more like a mystery.
This is more like a Sherlock Holmes thing, but with Batman. There's a lot of like clues. There's a lot of him actually like solving puzzles and crimes and things.
And if he's
like that idea.
He's Poirot, and he has his own book in the form of Commissioner Gordon. He's not a commissioner yet. He's just Detective Gordon in this one.
But in any case,
played by Jeffrey Wright, so it's a two-hander for a lot of it.
Yeah, which is fine. But in any case, so there's a serial killer. He's killing people, and in addition to leading people down this primrose path towards revealing the dark secrets behind Gotham City, he's also leaving messages specifically to the Batman.
Mm.
So they invite the Batman onto the crime scene, and the police are just like, there's a couple of police are like, should he be? Isn't he a criminal? Like, is that okay?
And Commissioner Gordon just says, he's with me.
One of my favorite bits in the movie, it's later on, but it's not a spoiler. It's like someone's like, Batman like picks up a piece of evidence. Mm. And the guy's like, hey, is he allowed to do that? Isn't that like something that could like invalidate the case? And Gordon's just like, we're going to let him do that. I'm like, we were the good guys.
The joke is, well, he's wearing gloves.
Which is admittedly kind of funny. But still, the idea is that he's not deputized here. He's not the Adam West version where he's part of the cops, but they're doing that thing he's hanging out with the cops.
Mm.
That's something we haven't really seen much of from Batman, except for a little bit in the Joel Schumacher ones.
And the 60s movies.
The 60s movie, but like the 60s movie, the Joel Schumacher ones, but the Tim Burton ones, he was way outside the purview of the police. The Nolan ones, most of the time, he was like, they were chasing after him.
Yeah.
Like the idea of Batman being cozy with the cops is something that it's not wrong because it's perfectly valid, but it's been so long since we've seen that in the movies that it took me a while to get used to that, because and a lot of things it's just weird to say like, here's this grim and gritty cop movie and we've got like cops with gloves and they're picking up blood and stuff like that, and we gotta analyze the spatter. Hey, Batman. And like, what? This is normal now? This is where we're at?
And the suit, I mean, it looks like a movie suit, I guess.
I like this movie suit, actually.
The plastic that they're trying to make look like metal.
I actually like this movie suit. I like that it's basically the Batman, like, Kevlar or whatever it is basically padding, and then he's just wearing pants underneath. Like, he's just wearing pants.
Pants like Doc Martens.
Yeah, he's got, like, some, like, hockey pads underneath like that, but he's got, like, you know, kind of a chainmail shirt, and the cape looks pretty good, and the helmet looks pretty good. Like, I actually like the overall look of this Batman. Yeah. I think it might be my favorite bat suit so far. I actually like it. Cool. I think it looks cool. There's a lot of aesthetic stuff in this movie.
Some aesthetic flourishes. Yeah. Like the Batman suit, for instance, has like a little Dracula collar.
Yeah.
Makes him look a little bit more
It protects his neck, and it hides the fact that, like, you know, a lot of the Batman suits, he couldn't move his neck because it was, like, kind of attached to the suit.
It was that big cowl thing.
Here you can just get away with that. You can just hide the fact that it's not attached, and you aren't calling attention to the fact that his neck is exposed.
He has a little nose piece so he can actually breathe through his nose, so we don't have the rock solid hunk of nose. So many of the previous costumes, the actors had to sort of like stick their lips out. It was like they're wearing a swim mask.
Yeah.
This one, they sort of let him have a little bit more freedom of breathing.
It's a little bit more practical for the actor. It looks more practical for the character. I like this suit a lot, actually. Right. Yeah.
The plot takes, deep into this web of corruption that will eventually involve a kidnapped young woman and her, quote, roommate, Selena Kyle. Her queerness is not made explicit in the movie, which is really frustrating. She calls her roommate baby in one scene.
Yeah.
You could kind of infer that they're lovers.
There's a lot to infer here.
But they don't outright use the word bisexual. They don't say that they're girlfriends, that they're living together, that they sleep
together.
There's
a lot
together.
That's None of that. Here.
There's no kisses.
Because, again, it's still a big budget movie that they want to release in a lot of international markets where you're not allowed to talk
where there
that.
Are bisexual people that Agreed. Would be good to be seeing that.
Maybe. I am not making an excuse. I am talking about their bullshit rationale.
Yeah, it's
just to be clear. I would have loved if we could be more
My
explicit.
Point is it's still bullshit. And,
it is. But she's played by Zoe Kravitz, and Zoe Kravitz is great.
Zoe Kravitz is a fine actress. I've seen her in good movies and bad movies.
Yeah. What I actually think is interesting.
She was in an X-Men film a while back. I think she was in First Class.
Was she in First Class? Was she Angel, the one with the wings?
It's
been a while.
So yeah, she played like a wasp-like character, and now she's in a Batman movie.
And she was in Mad Max Fury Road, and she was recently in Kimmy, which is very good.
Michelle Pfeiffer played Catwoman, and then was a wasp in a Marvel movie. A little bit of crisscross there.
Oh, I see what you're getting at. Okay, that makes sense. Zoe Kravitz's Catwoman, I'm going to say this right now, has a better arc than Batman does. Because she actually has a goal
that runs parallel to Batman's.
What happens is Batman is swept up in this story that involves crime boss played by John Turturro, another crime boss, the Penguin, played by Colin Farrell, under a lot of makeup. It looks pretty convincing. I still don't know why you needed Colin Farrell to play him, although I do think he's good in the part.
You get a guy who looks like that. You don't need all that, save some money on makeup.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weird choice, but I guess they really wanted that makeup Oscar. She's swept up in it because she has her own mission of revenge against the crime boss, Carmine Falcone, played by John Turturro. And she is on a mission of revenge for reasons we'll find out later on. And she is perfectly willing to kill. And over the course of meeting Batman and working with Batman, she changes. Whereas I feel this is the thing for me that I think keeps the movie from feeling anything other than superficial. Batman, who, you, as you mentioned, is in practically every scene, practically every frame of the film, has almost no story really of his own.
He's there to solve the crime.
He's the investigator in Law and Order. He's Sherlock Holmes. Most mysteries don't change Sherlock Holmes. Well, he comes in and he solves the problem.
There's a little bit of an existential crisis for Batman / Bruce Wayne when he also realizes that in this gigantic web of complications, his parents are somehow involved.
Right, and I was going to get to that.
And I'm not going to say how or why.
No, that would be rude.
It's a gigantic conspiracy that involves a lot of players, and his parents are ancillary players.
But the idea is this: at the beginning of the movie, we see almost none of the film has Robert Pattinson playing Bruce Wayne. There's a couple of scenes with Alfred. There's like one scene where he goes to a funeral.
Alfred is played by Andy Serkis in this version.
Good casting. I like Andy Serkis a lot. But he's almost never Bruce Wayne. And a lot of people have pointed out, well, the plot is he doesn't want to be Bruce Wayne. He wants to be Batman right now. And I'm like, that makes sense. I get that that's what they're explicitly stating. But by never showing him as Bruce Wayne, by never showing him interacting with people as a person, as opposed to a citizen, the knight, you know, like, as opposed to a over-the-top caricature of a person, which he's doing intentionally, we never really see what being Batman has done to him. We never really see the human toll that that has taken. We never really see what disconnects him from humanity that makes him only want to be the Batman. Yeah. And as a result, when the Batman goes through something resembling a change at the end, but we never see how that affects Bruce Wayne or how Bruce Wayne will interact with people from now on, it ends up feeling pretty minor, because I feel ultimately the character arc that Batman goes through, people will say like, oh yeah, well, he learns to be like not so focused on vengeance and be more like inspiring as a hero, which is not a spoiler. That's very thin.
And it's really rushed.
It's really rushed. It's in a voiceover.
It's not a big part of
the movie. It's mentioned in a voiceover. And like, the idea
feels like a studio cover. It's like, we need something to kind of
make it feel like it was Bruce Wayne's story in some way. And like, but here's the thing though. It's like at the beginning of the movie, what's the first thing we see Batman doing? Saving innocent lives, beating up bad guys. And how does he prove that he's changed at the end of the film? Well, he saves innocent lives and he beats up bad guys.
Yeah.
He's not actually changed much. And I think that removing Bruce Wayne from the equation, which I get they wanted to focus on the Batman. They wanted it to be like an old, like a proper comic book Batman story. We don't see a lot of Bruce Wayne. It's kind of irrelevant to the tale we're telling. But when you remove that, we're not getting that humanity from the character. Well, and I'm
kind of okay with that with a character like Batman, because he is a broad caricature. He's Batman, for goodness sake. I don't necessarily need for him to have like a really meaningful arc as a character.
I'm not asking for something huge, but if you're going to give it, I want it to work.
I think it's just another thing where they're sort of padding this thing out to a 3-hour running time.
Yeah.
They're making the story so complicated that we're meant to extrapolate from this movie something kind of meaningful about humanity, and I don't think it's there.
Oh, it's not, and that's the thing. Like, I feel like the mystery, you know, the point of a mystery isn't just to figure out who done it; it's to figure out why, like what happened to all of these characters that gave them the motivation to commit these crimes. What is the secret truth underlying everyone's facade? And we never get that for most people. And honestly, once we do solve the mystery, and I'm not going to ruin who did it or whatever, it's pretty much, and the person we thought did it, like that kind of thing, or we thought maybe this person was bad. They're fine. Like, there's not actually like nothing. No one's perception of who these people are has dramatically changed at the end of this thing. It's all pretty much reassured.
They state the thesis right at the start, and while there's like a few twists and turns, none of them are so change a lot of the fabric of what's going on in the story.
Was it evil guy number one who's the one we're all looking for, or was it evil guy number two or three?
It was one of them, and it turns out that evil guy was evil. That's the big reveal.
And all the little clues and stuff are really, really fun for the most part. I like there's like a gag with a thumb drive
I love the thumb drive gag.
There's good like individual bits of business, but the question is, what do they lead to? And I don't think they lead to much. I think they lead to something that's pretty pat and obvious, they're kind of just hiding it under style and length and action.
And the film also has a really frustrating tendency to offer up some pretty high stakes and then retract them almost immediately. There's a scene where we think a character's dead, but they're not. There's a scene where it looks like something has been revealed, but then it wasn't. There's a scene where it looks like someone might have been corrupt, but they weren't. It's like they do it at least 3 times in the movie where there's like some big revelation that actually would have changed the nature of the story.
Right.
And then they immediately walk it back in the following scene.
It's amazing how, and honestly, I think Matt Reeves gets away with it so well because he's kind of hiding it behind style.
A lot of really impressive style.
But once that washes away, once you cease to be impressed by how like neat it looks, you realize that what's actually being conveyed underneath all that is actually not that interesting. And that's really, really frustrating. And so we get a lot of these kind of cool surface scenes. There's this one car chase, everyone's talking about it. It's covered in an interesting way, where, like, the camera is always locked down on the Batmobile, so it's always looking forward at the Penguin as he's chasing him, but the Penguin's camera's always looking back behind him, and it's, you would normally never cover a car chase like that, with just, like, two cars mounted on, cameras mounted on cars. But, it's a cool sequence. There's, like, trucks that explode and everything, and it's all fucking awesome. And it's like, okay, so Batman really needed to get to that Penguin, right? He really needed to get him. And in order to do that, it was totally worth the collateral damage of destroying all those vehicles and probably seriously injuring or killing people in the process. And then what emerges from the Q&A with the Penguin after that? Now, I'm not going to reveal what, but it was not fucking worth that carnage.
No, and it, in fact, it ends in this sort of, like, almost comedic Q&A
kind of
with
joke.
The Penguin.
Yeah.
The Penguin's sort of a comedic character in this movie.
Yeah. Like, he's a crime boss, but he's not, like, in and of himself threatening, and he's actually, like, he'll sit down with you. He sits down with the Batman and has a conversation. I kind of like that, actually. I thought that was kind of fun to just to see Batman be casual with people.
I feel like as a character, just sort of generally speaking, I know the character has 80 years of history, but...
And many iterations, all of them do at this point. There's 80 different Catwoman, 80 different Batman, 80 different Penguins.
If you look at sort of like the fundamental idea of Batman, it's a rich man in a suit. Like, he's not a special guy, he's not a suit.
Well, he's special because he's dedicated his life to training.
Yeah, he's a freelance detective who fights and has no compunction beating up bad guys.
Yeah.
It makes more sense in that with that idea of Batman that he fights organized crime.
Sure.
Human beings up to no good.
Yeah.
This idea that Batman is always fighting, like, big, wacky characters who are, like, breaking out of asylums and, like, you know, making sort of, you know, like the Joker is like, I made a 5-foot penny and I'm going to tie you to one side and then flip it. You know.
Yeah, it's a different vibe. We're not there yet.
Keep in mind, I do like that kind of stuff.
That's all right. But that's the thing. There's no, like, some people made a big deal about, oh, this is such an accurate Batman to one version.
Yeah, which version is
that? Like, there's a million different Batman. They're all pretty valid.
The one on the 60s TV show is accurate to Batman as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of different versions of Batman. They're all pretty valid. They made their choices and they stuck to them. In some cases, they gain something from that. In some cases, they lose something from that. Again, I maintain this is pretty soulless. In a lot of ways, except for the Catwoman arc. I think Zoe Kravitz is really bringing it.
Yeah.
But most everyone else is just operating within the plot.
Yeah.
They're just functions of plot.
And the plot isn't so interesting and so revelatory that it warrants all of this extra meat that's hanging off.
Not really, no.
Trim it down a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, careful. Me, knocking things around.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I found the film to be just terrifically dull.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of good individual bits, a lot of fun details, a lot of fun things that you can sort of have conversations about. But, yeah, at the end, I felt like I hadn't gained a whole lot from this movie. That there wasn't a lot that was really entertaining me or engaging me or engaging with sort of any ideas.
Yeah.
It's like their ambition was incredibly modest. Yeah. They just wanted to make what was essentially baseline reading Batman.
Well, I guess
they're not going to deviate from any kind of norm. I feel like every version of Batman, everybody says that's the most accurate one. Everyone that comes
along. Every new one that happens. Yeah.
The only one they didn't say that about was, I think...
Batman and Robin.
It was Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
They're just trying to... Every time they come around, it's like, no, we're going to do sort of like just the straight version of Batman.
We're going to get Batman right this time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And now this feels like... Your ambition was just to give you the most straightforward, boring version of Batman you can.
The idea was to give you the sort of prototypical Batman, which some people have argued we've never properly had. I disagree, but whatever, who cares?
They say it out every time.
But who cares? That's the point. It's like this is a version of Batman that in this particular form has never quite made it to the screen. And for people who really like that version of Batman, this is definitely going to feel like a breath of fresh air. Oh, I've always wanted to see this. Thank you very much. But beyond just that aesthetic, if you want a story that actually feels like a game changer for Batman, this is not it. This is actually pretty rote and ultimately doesn't lead to a lot of significant new interpretations of the character or anything like that. The one thing I tweeted about this, and I gave a quick tweet, my reaction to Batman, because I wasn't able to see it early. I wasn't able to publish a review early, so I figured I'd wait for the podcast, but I'll give my quick thoughts. And one of my thoughts, and I've mentioned it here, was that I think the film's choice, it's obviously a conscious choice, no one's pretending it's not, to sideline Bruce Wayne as a character makes the film lose something. I think it loses a lot of the soul of the character. And some people say, like, well, it's not Bruce Wayne, he's Batman. They're the same fucking person. I know there's this whole thing duality about, like, thing, like Batman's, like, there's a one point where the Riddler says, yeah, the mask is the real you. And I'm like, yeah, it's the Riddler saying that. I don't think we're supposed to take him as gospel now.
And that's that was a big part of the Tim Burton film Batman Returns.
Yeah.
Where
duality.
How honest is the mask? How honest are you without the mask?
Which is one of the reasons why Batman Returns is my favorite Batman movie, because it understands how
liberating and indeed it's kind of a cold movie, but there's most certainly a sexual element to it.
And it's funny too.
About sort of putting on the outfit and, you know, sort of using that superherodom as this weird facade for sexuality.
What I like about Batman Returns the most, I think, over time, is that I think it's the only Batman movie. Every other Batman movie picks a side of Batman they're going to use. Is it going to be the funny Batman? Is it going to be the sexy Batman? Is it going to be the action Batman? Is it going to be the dark and gritty Batman? And I think Batman Returns may be the only movie, I know comics have done it effectively, but maybe the only movie that understands it's all of those things.
Yeah.
They don't, you can't live without one of them forever. You can't be humorless forever, but you also can't be just jokey forever. You can't ignore the psychology and psychosexual elements, but you also can't pretend that there isn't a surface-level thrill here. So Batman Returns is maybe the only one that actually tries to balance all of those elements and talk about the characters in an intelligent way while also having weird, goofy bits and fun action and really gross, scary stuff. And I think it does that really well.
It's the horror stuff in Batman Returns. I really appreciate that.
But my point was this. They chose to sideline Bruce Wayne so they can tell a story about Detective Batman. Fine. I think that as a result of that, you lose a lot of the character of Batman. A lot of people said, you don't understand. He's it's year two. He hasn't made his choices yet. Like, I don't care about that. You had 3 hours to tell a story. You could have put some more character development in here. But then someone made the point, while they were chewing me out and calling me really mean names, so I did block them, but they made a good point. made a good point, and their point was this. Their interpretation, and no one else had said this.
All right.
Not yet, anyway. I've muted the thread since. I just didn't have the time. But no one else, everyone else had just said, hey, he said he didn't want to be Bruce Wayne, therefore it's fine. I'm like, no, that's a creative decision that they made. It's not inherently good or bad. Someone pointed out, while they were being mean to me, this Batman is autistic.
Oh, there you go.
And I'm going to say this.
If he has that sort of obsessive sort of focus on small details.
There's a lot
that,
of...
That could be read as being on the spectrum.
There's a lot of different elements of this particular version of Batman, the way Robert Pattinson plays him, everything from the social anxiety to the emphasis on hyper detail, that could be interpreted as autistic. The movie never comes out and says it, but it could be interpreted as autistic. And if that's the...
They would just say it, but
Well... There is also a story element that comes in later on that I can't go into in great detail, which brings up the possibility of a history of mental health issues in the Wayne family.
Oh, yeah.
I think it handles that storyline incredibly badly, because I think ultimately the movie says it's something to be kind of ashamed of, which is fucked up. But regardless, it is supported that, you know, this may be an issue that he's dealing with. This may be the Batman that we have right now. And if so, that is interesting. That is an interesting choice. In order to really make that dramatically interesting, not just as an idea, you need to show it. And they don't get an opportunity to do so, because we never see him as Bruce Wayne. We only get to see him under the mask where he feels comfortable.
Or if there's a moment where, even if he's still in the outfit, like he's at a crime scene and he, let's say he has like some sort of obsessive like habit, something.
And we don't. And by the way, this is not all autistic people that we're talking about.
I'm trying to think of how can we dramatize this better.
If
that was their goal, if this was to show a Batman who was on the spectrum, and they would need to communicate that in ways other than just being his obsession with crime.
And so my point is that if that is your interpretation of this Batman, which they never explicitly say, and if they wanted to, they could walk it back, I think it'd be a mistake. Interesting, but I don't think it's dramatized very well, and I think they could have done a lot more with it that would have made the character more engaging rather than less... we'd feel more connected to him rather than less connected to him, because we'd understand what he was going through better. Whereas as it stands, just having it be subtext is, okay, it's interesting. It actually changed my perspective of the film a little bit, but it's, I don't think it's ultimately handled very well. Mm. I think ultimately what we've got here, listen, I like this movie more than you do. I know we've spoken almost exclusively about the criticisms, and that's because the stuff that I like is pretty straightforward.
Well, it's the surface stuff, right?
But the surface stuff is cool. Like, I will say this. I actually really like the overall visual aesthetic. I think the cinematography is interesting.
Mm.
I like a lot of the ideas for the storyline. I think the overall structure of how they use the Riddler is very different from other versions of the character. Mm. The Riddler is my favorite Batman villain. I make no bones about that. This is a very different version of him. Maybe not my favorite, but I think it's neat. I think they did a good job with that story element. I like the way that it feels like Gotham is kind of fully formed and we're not really introducing everything. We're just kind of dropping ourselves into the middle of it.
Mm.
I think that is that's something we can get away with in superhero storytelling now. And I think they're confident and they get away with that. I appreciate that a lot of the action sequences are filmed in a way that is very atypical for the genre. And I think
Swirling CGI cameras. Yeah,
not a lot of show-off-y stunts. Like, there's a whole bit where, like, Batman has to jump off something and it's covered in a very distinct way. And it looks really cool. I like the overall stylistic elements. I think the cast is uniformly good, whether or not their roles lead to much. They're all good. John Turturro's great in this. It's been a while since I've seen him get a meaty role.
I've seen bad movies with John Turturro, but he is always good in his movie.
You want to see a bad movie where John Turturro kills it? Collateral Damage with Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's got two scenes where he's in a jail cell with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's like someone told him this is a Coen Brothers movie. Like, go for it. He's always killing it, and he's really good.
He's been in several of those Michael Bay Transformers movies.
Yeah, and he's always given 110%. He's goofing it up for the kids, you know, which is fine.
But you know, that's a note he can work on, isn't it? Do you ever see, I think it was called Aging Gigolo?
Aging Gigolo?
What was the movie
Avenging Angelo?
The John Turturro movie where he played a gigolo. I think it's called Aging Gigolo.
I don't know that one.
He was really good in that movie.
Okay. That totally flew by me. The cast is good. The aesthetics are good. I didn't, not enjoy watching the film at all. I just felt shockingly little, considering how much time they had, how much, literal screen time they had, how much they tried to cover in terms of, revealing stuff about Gotham's backstory and Bruce Wayne's backstory.
Apologies, it was called Fading Gigolo.
Okay, you're close. It still doesn't ring a bell,
He was in it and he directed it as well.
He's directed it a few times. Didn't he do, the Illusion Defense as well?
He's played a chess master.
I just feel like it's a whole lot of ado for a pretty superficial takeaway. So I liked it more than you. I don't think it's I'm not going to give it a C- at the end of the day, but it's definitely not a C+. There's a lot of things here that just are really holding it back, and it just feels like they wanted to look like they had the ambition without actually achieving anything genuinely ambitious beyond the aesthetics.
Yeah.
And that feels like they're pulling your punches. Chris Nolan, not to compare, but Chris Nolan didn't pull punches. He at least tried to, even when you could argue that some of his decisions were a mistake. Dark Knight Rises, it takes some big swings in there, and some of them are weird.
But he's
trying there. Tim Burton tried to do something weird. Joel Schumacher tried to do something weird. And I feel like here we're trying to toe the line. We're trying to hit the notes that you want, audience.
Not weird as possible. I'm not sure if I get sort of the sense that it's pandering, because they're not doing...
There's not a lot of fan service.
Here's something I admire about the movie, and it's kind of hard to say that you admire a movie for what's not in it, but when
there's so many different versions of it, and you're aware of what the options are, that you know that the decision not to include something was a conscious choice.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea of introducing well-worn characters that audiences have a connection to already...
Yeah.
In a very non-flashy sort of way. When we first see Catwoman in The Dark Knight Rises, there's kind of a reveal. She is actually in disguise as a maid, and then she's kind of changes character very silently.
And the whole audience can go, ha-ha.
She gets to do something really slinky out the window, and that's oh, that's a fun moment. And I like that moment. And I like Anne Hathaway in that movie. But that's very showy, isn't it? Or trying to think of when... like the Riddler first enters the room in Batman Forever. It's like, you can call me the Riddler. And he's already wearing
the
outfit.
Well, there's a good bit. It's not a great movie, but like at the beginning of Batman Forever, you see half of Tommy Lee Jones giving a monologue. Yeah. And then only at the end of it, when he like completely like pulls a 180 and gets fully manic, does the camera turn around and you see that half of his face is all scarred up.
Really terrible makeup job.
Blind, stinking, stupid, doodah, clueless lock.
Tommy Lee Jones has given one bad performance, and it's in Batman Forever. I don't think he knew what he was doing. He was just sort of like cackling and just doing this generic villain
monster.
Why
do you get Tommy Lee Jones, like one of the best actors you could possibly get?
He can play really like subdued and nuanced.
That's the thing. He can play quiet. More intensely than any other actor. And I get he's playing Two-Face, a two-sided character. Why do you only tell him to play it up? Shouldn't it be half and half?
Mm.
Isn't that kind of the point? Is that he's half Harvey Dent, this, like, man about town, you know, respected citizen, lawyer, guy with principles, and half homicidal maniac?
Here's what I love
about that. Why is he only homicidal maniac? That always bugged me about that movie. Why is he only one side in that movie? It's so weird.
Here's something I kind of appreciate about that version of Two-Face. He lives in a polyculi. He has two girlfriends.
Yeah.
And one of them is played by Debbie Mazar. She's like the goth girl, the suicide girl kind of girlfriend.
Their names are Sugar and Spice.
Sugar and Spice. And Sugar is played by Drew Barrymore. She's always dressed in white and feathers.
Yeah.
And
I
like to think that Harvey Dent, you know, were he not Two-Face, would still be dating Drew Barrymore. Like this sort of like feathery, lightweight character.
Yeah.
But
he would, but.
But it's only after he became Two-Face that he also gets to date Debbie Mazar.
He would be dating Drew Barrymore, but there would come that point, because he's like a politician and like a celebrity, Debbie Mazar is the person that he ends up sleeping with at a bar.
Oh, there you go.
You know, like, it's, like, totally different from his wife, that kind of thing. You know, like, that's the kind of, like,
whatever. Now he gets to date both of them simultaneously.
Yeah, like, one of my, like, my favorite version of Two-Face is still from the animated series, because they actually did a whole bit about how he had a split personality before his face was scarred.
Oh, okay.
And the scarring just solidified it. Like, it just made him, he wasn't trying to fight it anymore. Mm. And so you got to see that he was a person dealing with serious issues. That's a really good version of that character. I love Tommy Lee Jones as an actor. That is one of the worst Batman villains we've ever had.
It's so bad.
It doesn't work. But
it took me all day, but I did write an article for Slash Film. It was one of those, you know, sort of clickable articles where it's just ranking all the villains in all the Batman movies.
Yeah.
And I put Tommy Lee Jones right near the bottom.
Yeah, who was your
Dr. Daka is the worst from the 1943 serial.
Okay. Well,
racist stereotype.
Then yes, that's
they got an Irish actor to play a Japanese man and
okay, well then there's no beating that.
Yeah, you can't
most really people most people wouldn't even include that. Kudos for you for doing it. I always appreciate when you're like, oh, we're going to review every single one of these ever. And what they actually mean is the ones we saw.
Yeah,
and I'm like, no, you should do the damn research. Come on.
It's not that four of the Star Wars movies.
Like, what the shit? Like, come on. Like, oh, it drives me up the wall. So
anyway, at the end of the day, I was just, I didn't feel any kind of exhilaration during Batman. I wasn't excited by it. Walked away from a pretty boring, dull kind of a flick.
I there's stuff I like about it, and I'll probably watch it again someday, maybe give it another chance, see if there's something that like I didn't catch up on it, but I feel pretty confident in my takeaway. But there's definitely stuff I like. It is far from my least favorite Batman movie, like really far from it. But it's also really far from it's not even in my top five.
Mm.
But I also only think that there are like one or two genuinely bad Batman movies that don't have a lot to recommend them. And even those usually have a couple of fun bits. Like, Batman and Robin is... I know there's been, like, some attempt to reclaim Batman and Robin as kind of a camp masterpiece.
It's a fucking chore.
It's actually...
It's really hard to sit through.
I want to get there with you. I'm totally like, okay with the camp Batman.
Like, color and crazy stuff in it, but
conceptually, that's all a good idea.
Difficult to sit through.
It's awkwardly edited. It's the storytelling is junky. There's too many characters.
It's also ugly to look at.
It's not attractive. How did you do that? That's the thing. The thing you can say at the very least about Batman Forever is everyone looks great.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
He just, that was the whole thing. Joel Schumacher wanted to do a sexy Batman. We're gonna do Batman and everyone's hot, and I'm like, okay, yeah, let's do that. That sounds great. And then cast, he just,
you know, Studley Val Kilmer and, you know, make Nicole Kidman look like a 40s movie siren.
And then he's like, I'm going to do that, but everyone's like a little less hot, and I'm going to make the cinematography a little murkier, and the camera angle's kind of warped, and it's going to actually be kind of hard to look at him almost
of
the time.
It's going to be more expensive, but look cheaper somehow. I did that.
Anyway, well, I think the cast probably was a big part of that price tag, but anyway. But anyway, The Batman. I liked it more than Whitney did. I'll probably be kinder to it at the end of the day when we do a review wrap-up. But yeah, I don't think it's particularly good. But let's move on, because that is not the only movie that opened this weekend. Nobody's talking about the other movies, and that is a shame, because at least one or two of them are really good.
Well, I want to hear you talk about After Yang, because I missed this one, and I really wanted to see it. I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Okay, so
tell me about After Yang.
After Yang also stars Colin Farrell,
who played Batman.
He played Batman.
Didn't he? No, he didn't play Batman.
He played the Penguin.
He played.
We're gonna do this.
He played Bullseye in Daredevil.
He did play Bullseye in Daredevil. He's actually good. I like that movie.
He's been in a couple other comic book stuff as well, hasn't he? I'm thinking of SWAT. He was in SWAT.
He's done some action stuff. He was in Miami Vice, which is a very good movie. But one of the things I like about Colin Farrell is that he'll do the big stuff. You know, he'll do Saving Mr. Banks or whatever. He'll do Studio Fair. But I think it feels like his heart and soul is in the quieter indie stuff. And this is one of my favorite Colin Farrell movies. Not that he gives a particularly showy performance. In fact, if you like put him side by side with The Batman and After Yang, you probably wouldn't recognize him. But this is a very peaceful, sweet, and kind movie. Colin Farrell plays a father in the future. It's an interesting look at the future, too, because initially you can't even tell it is the future. And then you realize that, okay, what is different? Well, one thing is different about this future is that at some point in this somewhat semi-utopian future, all of society seem to have gotten around renewable resources. So there aren't a lot of synthetics. Everything's really earthy. But also, nobody in the film has their own children. He has a neighbor played by Clifton Collins Jr., great actor. And all his kids are clones. Meanwhile, Colin Farrell has an adopted daughter. She's Chinese. Mm-hmm. With his wife, played by Jodie Turner-Smith. And in order to make sure she feels a connection to her cultural roots, which they don't pretend to be, you know, Chinese, they have purchased a robot named Yang, played by Justin H. Min.
So it's like a human-looking robot.
It's a humanoid. What do they call them? They call it like a techno-human or something. But it's kind of like a new kind of life, basically, but it is artificially made. And he's designed to be the perfect sibling, and also he's full of knowledge about her Chinese heritage so that she can learn more about that and not have that part of her life neglected, because Colin Farrell and Jodie Turner-Smith, however well-intentioned, aren't part of that. And the fact that this is an actual function of these kinds, this isn't like a unique robot created just for that purpose. This is a thing that happens a lot. So I guess there's a lot of adoptions going on in this future. But we never really get into that. At the beginning of the movie, we see them in their domestic family life, and they're super happy. Okay. And then Yang breaks.
Just breaks down.
He breaks down. It's like you get a red ring of death on your Xbox 360. Broken.
And they have to hire Melanie Griffith to go into the wastelands to go get a new one.
Yeah, it is kind of like a chill
movie. Cherry 2000.
Cherry 2000 is one of my favorite sci-fi movies, and it is about a future. And this is a movie kicks ass, by the way. It takes place in a future where A, there's been an apocalypse and half the world is like a fucking wasteland. But B, sexual politics have gotten so complicated that singles bars, people bring their lawyers. And Lawrence Fishburne plays one of the lawyers. It's really funny.
It was made during the AIDS epidemic, and how
that changed casual sex.
Exactly.
Forever.
You can't just sort of go to a bar and have casual sex, because now there's a risk of...
Yeah, everyone's being a lot more conscious.
Even more diseases than before.
And so the premise of Cherry 2000 was there's a protagonist who has a sex robot. that he lives with. It's his girlfriend slash wife. And at the beginning of the movie, she breaks, and it turns out that she's an older model, and the only way to get the replacement part is to go into the Mad Max Badlands, so he has to hire a tracker, played by Melanie Griffith, to help him fix his sex bot. It's great. Tim Thomerson plays an amazing villain in it. He's got, like, it's like, imagine if, like, Immortan Joe and his gang of, like, badass mutants were like a cheerful cult. Like a cheerful one. Where it's just like, okay, everybody, like, there's a bit where Tim Thomerson is like telling his guys to go kill everybody. It's like, okay, be polite but firm. Like, just anyway, Cherry 2000 is great. But the idea is Yang is broken. And unfortunately, even though he's under warranty, he was under warranty with the store they bought it from, but not the manufacturer, because he was refurbished. So they can't get him fixed.
They got a refurbished model. That's pretty funny.
So a lot of the movie is him trying to, if possible, get Yang fixed. And if not, well, we'll have to have a talk with... The daughter knows that he was a robot, but they still care about him. And over the course of the movie, he begins to understand what life with their family was like for Yang, a sort of burgeoning form of artificial intelligence that actually have had a complicated inner world that they never even seriously considered, because to him, they cared about him. But they cared about him maybe the way that you'd care about the family cat. Like, you care, they mean a lot to you, you'll be sad when they go away, but you don't know what they're dreaming about.
Is this like an artificially intelligent robot, or does it just look like a human?
No, it's artificially intelligent, he's got distinctions in his programming, and a lot of the movie is about people remembering Yang. And we finally, at some point in the film, we actually get a chance to look at Yang's memories. But it's not just he recorded everything. He actually had a choice of what memories to keep. What memories are important to a robot, and they're not what you might think. And it's incredibly beautiful to see these, like, people who are leaving relatively normal lives. He owns a tea shop. She works at some kind of business somewhere where they, I think, advertising or whatever like that. They leave a relatively normal, semi-affluent life. And just this raised awareness of the humanity of someone that they took for granted, loved, but took for granted, becomes this sort of flowering state of raised consciousness where they truly come to an understanding about someone. It's like, imagine if after I died, okay, let's say I died before you do, probably will. 50-50 shot anyway.
I'm older than you, dude.
I know. But I make bad choices. No, I don't know. I bet I could jump off this cliff and land on my feet. What do you think? Like, anyway, but whatever. Let's say I die before you do. And let's say you had an opportunity to rifle around in my brain.
I'll do that anyway.
Wouldn't you? Let's say you could actually look through your Oculus Rift or whatever like that, and you can actually see my favorite memories of you. That would be a profound experience.
Oh, I wouldn't want to do that, though.
Well, you don't have to do that, but it would be a profound experience if you did. And that is something that this movie is actually trying to get at, is, like, what is it like to live inside an artificially intelligent mind that is also maybe... There's a great bit where he's talking to a clone, and he's talking about, like, who knew Yang. And he's like, did Yang ever say he wished he was human? And she's like, that is such a human thing to say. What is so fucking special about being human? Did you ever think about being Yang? Like, it's something we've talked about this a lot when we're talking about Star Trek and our Star Trek podcast on Patreon. Well, the character of Data and even Spock, where this idea is that, oh, they're not human. They need to learn what it's like to be human. And it's a very geocentric kind of view of sci-fi. The idea that everything revolves around us and we're going to use characters who are not us to help us explore what it means to be us.
Which is forgivable when you remind yourself that the show is made by humans.
Of course it is. But when you think of it, like, within the universe of the show, however, it's a little insulting, isn't it?
There is a lot of geocentricism to Star Trek.
Exactly. And, like, so the idea that, like, oh, did Yang want to be human? Maybe Yang just wanted to be Yang, man. Like, it raises such beautiful questions.
It's fascinating.
It's something that they'd never seriously considered before. And there's something just inherently beautiful. But this is a film directed by Koganada. They had previously done the movie Columbus. Starring John Cho.
I like Columbus. And
I think it's Haley Lou Richardson who's also in this.
It is.
He's an incredibly powerful filmmaker who, through use of silence and through the use of clever framing, can make movies that are very pensive completely absorbing and thrilling.
Yeah.
And this is one of my favorite science fiction films in a really long time.
All right.
Just period, which is saying something.
We just reviewed another one of my favorites on our shorts podcast. It's called Hold Please.
Oh yeah, there's an Oscar nominated short this year, which is a great science fiction story that completely relates to the prison system, the way it works now. Really, if you get a chance, see Hold Please. It's fantastic. It's like 12 minutes long. It's great. But this is a brilliant, brilliant sci-fi film, and I'm going to say this thing, and I say it a lot, not as often as I'd like, for reasons of what I'll explain in a minute, but it is way too early in the year to start saying this is one of the best movies of the year.
It's March, you can start.
No, I'm not going to do it. I think it's bullshit. I think I've heard people say, like, oh, what Oscars will the Batman be up for? I'm like, I don't know. Let's wait 10 months and see what it's up against.
Let's wait 10 months and see if we're even talking about it.
Also fair, but my point is this. It's too early to call this one of the best movies of the year. But, and this is something I'll say whenever this comes up, if this doesn't make my top 10 of the year list, we're going to have a great year of cinema. Because this is an intensely moving, interesting, thoughtful, engaging. Colin Farrell is so wonderful in this movie. Like, everything about this movie is legitimately great. And I hope people see it. It is currently on Showtime. In addition to being in certain theaters, I beg of you, don't miss this movie. It is so wonderful. I was having a conversation with a friend, and we were talking about movies that are sort of inspirational, like, make you feel like, oh, life is great, isn't it? And I realized I don't have a lot of those. There's not a lot of movies that I turn to. It's like, tell me the world's a better place. Like, there's only a small handful, and other than that, I just look for quality cinema to remind me of that. This is a movie that I feel makes me feel better about being alive. How often can you say that? So please see, you need to see this movie because you're going to love this. But I hope everyone else at home does too, because this movie is amazing.
I know it's playing in certain theaters right now, probably just in big cities. And probably. And it's on, weirdly enough, Showtime.
Yeah, it's on Showtime, which is unusual. Usually it's something like this usually opens on, like, if it's going to open a theater, it's probably open on, like, streaming as well of that. But the important thing is that more people can see it.
Yeah.
I think that's what counts.
Well, once it's sort of a little bit more, because I don't have Showtime. In some ways, I just don't want to go to the trouble.
How many streaming services are we supposed to have at this point?
Exactly. It's like
in addition to cable, if you want that too,
just to see this one. It's not worth it. Future film.
You can if you want. You can. They do have free trials. So if you want to, like, get Showtime for a week, watch this movie, and then cancel it, you can. You can only do that so many times. But I will say this time would be worth it.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I missed it. I've heard nothing but good things about it.
Well, then let's move on to the movie that only you saw and I didn't, which is called Asking for It.
Okay. Asking for It is one of the worst films of the year. It is very, very,
statement.
Very bad.
Oh, no.
This comes from a long, broad tradition of the colloquially known genre known as rape revenge stories, which started up in the night.
It's an unpleasant subject, but that's what the movie's about, and we gotta talk about it.
It's about a group of young vigilantes who are sort of on a quest to undo misogyny, and there's a lot of echoes of Promising Young Woman in here. Well, just all the more notable films in the genre.
Well, the I think the best one of these we've seen, and this is only our opinion, obviously, but as much as I like Promising Young Woman, was Sweet Vicious, series on MTV.
That was really good.
It was about two college students who become vigilantes on campus and basically beating the crap out of anyone who takes advantage of women.
Yeah.
It lasted one season. You can watch that one season and get the complete and get a complete story out of it. It's not like you're going to end on a cliffhanger. It's really good.
The pilot is awful, but after the pilot, it's actually really quite
good. It's a difficult thing to set up, but once it's set up, it's fine. And the episode's only 30 minutes long, so they get out of it real fast.
But yeah, the main character is a young woman named Joey. She's played by the actress Kiersey Clemons.
Okay, from Zack Snyder's Justice League.
That's right. She was the woman in the flipping upside down car that the Flash rescued.
When the Flash stole a hot dog and weird goo-goo eyes at her while she was
the one driving.
Yeah, that was weird. She was also in Lady and the Tramp. Remake.
I didn't see the remake of Lady and the Tramp. I haven't seen the original either. But
oh, really? Weird.
You know,
okay.
There's a lot of those. You know, the Disney animated classic. I haven't seen.
She was in Hearts Beat Loud. Mm-hmm. She's in the new The Flash movie. Was she in that remake of? She's in that remake of Flatliners.
Yeah. Remember when they remade Flatliners?
I remember Diego Luna was in it.
I saw it. Neither did I. And Elliot Page is in it too.
It's not a good film.
And neither is this. But yeah, at the beginning of the movie, she reunites with an old friend. She goes out on a date with this old friend, and that leads to a sexual assault. And she's emotionally damaged by this, and is unable to confront this guy. And is just now living in a world of fear because she has been attacked. And one of the regulars at the diner where she works, played by Alexandra Shipp, recognizes that she's been damaged and takes her in like under her wing. And she's like sort of like this hip punk rock girl with the docks and really cool outfit. Takes her into this underground world where all of these hip young women have been conspiring to undo the work of this like online pundit who's a lot like Tom Cruise's character from Magnolia, where he sort of preaches about how men are to be are the dominant ones and women are supposed to be submissive, and there's all this racism implicit in all of that as well, and a lot of this right-wing politics. Uh-huh. He's played by Ezra Miller.
Oh.
So a little Justice League reunion there.
Weird. Okay. So they're operating as kind of like a secret society, or is it more like the X-Men? Like, how does this work exactly?
It's a little bit like a secret society, because they're all, like, super well-dressed, and we kind of see their flashback, like, their stories of how each of them was damaged in some way, or assaulted in some way, by a man, and how they've sort of come to this place. All this, like, really, like, 3 seconds of, like, quick still photography. And they're really trying to... They're trying to like ladle on this weird kind of mythology into this. Like this is almost a.
The start of a franchise.
Yeah, like they're trying to take assault very seriously, but at the same time, they're also just paying it lip service and giving it as sort of like this cheap way to give all of these female characters a lot of backstory. And as such, they're really doing a disservice to actual sufferers of sexual violence. So it's not handling anything responsibly. Vanessa Hudgens show up, and I do love Vanessa Hudgens.
She's brilliant.
And Vanessa Hudgens and Alexander Shippen is in this little Tick, Tick, Boom reunion
there
as
you
well.
Go.
Because they kind of played the same character.
There's good people
in
the film. It's a good cast overall,
Radha Mitchell is sort of like the den mother of this, and she's really good as well. I
underappreciated performer, if you ask me. Like,
she's got a lot of range, Radha Mitchell.
They tend not to get the best movie roles, which is a shame, but they're always really good. Yeah,
and they have this plot because, and they have a big tank of like supervillain gas that they're going to unleash on like this alt-right convention, and this gas will like sterilize all the men in the room. Okay. That's funny. You have all of these, like, this really hip cast, and they're all dressed as, like, these, like, punk rock vengeance women. Yeah. This movie should be, like, a little bit more fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be Switchblade Sisters.
Yeah, it should have, like, this, like, wicked like, sense of humor, and that there's, like, a sense of righteous indignation to it.
Yeah.
That's missing. This movie is just a downbeat drag.
But they've got Joker gas.
They've got Joker gas, and
we're
they're
taking
not
a deadly
having fun with it.
How do you take that deadly... I know, the topic itself, inherent, is deadly serious, but, like... When you're going to go that far in the pendulum swings that far in the other direction,
sort of like
this
like over the top revenge flick about sexual assault.
Yeah.
Already
you're treading on thin ice.
You're treading on thin ice, but there needs to be some rage in there. Yeah, there needs to be, like I said, righteous indignation, which I think is something something like Promising Young Woman had in spades. Yes. I actually admired the righteous indignation in that movie.
Yeah,
That's a big part of Sweet Vicious as well.
Yeah,
Sweet Vicious, I think, because of the TV series, had a lot more room to breathe and actually examined a lot more its sensitive topics with a lot more sensitivity.
Yeah,
this is just a movie. It's like 100 minutes.
A lot of movie revenge stories tend to be a little bit more direct.
The filmmakers are getting way too distracted with not just the mythology of the assault victims who have sort of formed this enclave of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
I think they don't have enough character. So they move around as sort of this amorphous mass.
Okay.
And they also try to give this weird sort of government conspiracy to the Ezra Miller character. How it's like in the pocket of the police. And there's like this other supervillain behind him who's like pulling the strings. And it doesn't play doesn't play with the reality well enough, and it doesn't play with the unreality well enough.
That sounds like the danger with that, though, when you start, because the idea is that who are they really fighting against? Misogyny as an entity.
Which is fine.
Saying that misogyny itself is like a government conspiracy? Which wouldn't that let like actual misogynists kind of off the hook?
Exactly. That's
you know, like, oh, there's an excuse. There's a MacGuffin behind your evil. It's like, no, evil is way more insidious than that. This doesn't come from like
a source.
We didn't all read a blog and turn evil one day. It's like, no, the evil comes from a lot of cultural signifiers.
I was reminded a lot of a movie that I actually did admire. I wish they had a bigger budget, but it was the latest version of Black Christmas.
I like that movie a lot. Yeah.
Which is also about the aftermath of a sexual assault and also about trying to find ways to make the assailants pay for their crimes in a system that protects them.
Yeah.
And in that movie, toxic masculinity is a physical substance.
It's literal.
It's something that you can actually drink. It's a toxin that you actually drink to become
it's
a toxin.
It's so fucking funny.
Which I think is actually a cute gag in that movie.
Yeah.
This movie, it doesn't play like a cute gag. It plays like this really ill-thought-out metaphor for... Yeah. They're trying to say that this toxic masculinity is insidious and it reaches very far. No, you already knew that going in.
Yeah.
Somebody was assaulted at the beginning. We get it.
Also, we live in the world.
We don't need this sort of fantasy version of it. Okay. And, it mishandles every single element. It mishandles the characters. It mishandles the actors, who are all very good actors otherwise.
Yeah.
The lead character is sort of robbed of a lot of her agency. We're not really sure what their goal is after they do the Joker gas thing, because there's another 45 minutes of movie after it.
Wow, okay.
It's badly edited. No. The tone is all over the place. There's all these disparate plot elements and characters that don't fit in. This is really, really bad.
You know,
it's just really badly put together. I'm reminded of a lot of... movies about sexual assault that were just made for $50 in like the early 80s.
Yeah, they're really trashy. Yeah.
The way sexual assault has been handled in movies historically has been very irresponsible.
Incredibly so. Yeah.
Especially if you've seen as many like bad B movies as I have.
Yeah.
When they use sexual assault as a way to sort of like sneak nudity into the movie.
Yeah, which is grotesque. It's terrible, it's a very irresponsible way to make movies. Yeah.
You know, I understand the need to put nudity in a film in a fun, zesty way.
Nudity is not in and of itself a problem, but the context matters.
Let's have fun with sex.
But the context really matters. If the sex isn't fun, the nudity can't be fun, or at least it shouldn't be.
No.
You shouldn't be equating horrifying.
They're using this horrible scene of violence in order to communicate something fun, and that's really horrendous.
Yeah, it's
there have been a few films recently though in this rape revenge genre.
Yeah,
that have been made by women.
Yeah,
there's a movie called simply Revenge. Which is really quite good. I saw a film last year, which wasn't well received by critics, but I appreciated, called simply Violation, which is also directed by a woman. And these are movies that are actually sort of looking at that indignation and sort of tactfully handling a lot of the emotional betrayal and physical betrayal that goes along with this horrendous crime. And those movies seem to have a lot more on their mind emotionally and dramatically than something like Asking for It, which is trying to be playful but isn't, is trying to be serious but isn't, and is trying to say something but doesn't.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Well, that doesn't sound like it's very good.
No.
Okay. Well, let's move on because we've got one more film left to talk about. And this is a horror movie that debuted at Sundance. And I got to see this back in, I didn't go anywhere because Sundance was canceled, but I did get to see this a little early. So I saw this about a month, and you saw Fresh, right?
I saw Fresh.
Okay, so Fresh is a new horror movie.
I saw it just a couple days ago.
My point is, you'll be a little bit more fresh. Fresh is a film from director Mimi Cave, and it is now on Hulu, and I like this movie a lot.
This
movie is really good.
Look, I've seen Yorg Butgarai films, and I've seen Solo, and I've seen Cannibal Holocaust. I've seen some pretty rough stuff.
Movies that are intended very specifically to push your boundaries of grossness.
To really repel
like
you.
Like, make you go, ah!
This is one of the only times my stomach kind of churned a little bit while watching a movie. This is pretty raw.
And
I've seen the movie Raw as well.
Yeah, that'd be a good double feature, actually. Fresh is the story of a young woman played by Daisy Edgar Jones. And it's you know what? It's 2022. Dating sucks.
Yeah, it's about how bad her modern dating experience is. It opens with her on the worst date possible.
Yeah, just that shitty internet hookup. Douchey
dude that is just talking about himself, wears a scarf, talks down to the waitress.
Insists on going Dutch and then takes her leftovers for himself. Like, just crappy.
When she finally just like... It's like, so, are we going to see each other again? She actually is honest, like, you know what, I'm just not feeling it.
This isn't working.
And then he insults her and walks away.
Yeah, like, you're the best you're ever going to get. Like, that kind of bullshit.
And then she looks at her phone, like, in the next scene, and it's just unsolicited nudity. It's like, oh, shit. It's like, dating is horrible.
Dating is horrible right now, and she actually just, by chance, is in a grocery store, and she meets a nice-seeming guy, played by Sebastian Stan from Captain America and the Winter Soldier. Captain America and the Falcon, the Captain America movies. You know what I'm talking about.
He's one of the Avengers.
And Sebastian Stan, by the way, I like him in those Marvel movies. He's a much more interesting actor than that.
Oh,
and it's
golly,
always
yes.
good to see him in something different. Here he gets to have so much fun. Mm-hmm.
I saw him in a movie called Monday last year, which...
Yeah.
Not a great film, but I think it was kind of interesting.
For the first half hour of this pretty brief movie, it's 2 hours, but it's very spry.
It
moves along at a fast clip. First half hour of this movie is a rom-com.
It's
just them getting to know each other, and it's cute, and you buy their chemistry, and they're great together, and they dance, and you really want them to get together.
And he's cautious.
Yeah.
He understands that he's actually like very open and talkative about his feelings. It's like, well, I know how certain kinds of behavior can be seen as suspicious, so I'm not going to do that. He's not flawless rescue stud. He's actually kind of a little bit sensitive human being.
Yeah, like there's a whole bit where they're eating dinner together, and she's eating a sandwich, and he's like eating a salad or whatever like that. So are you vegetarian? It's like, yeah, I don't eat animals. She's like, oh my God, it feels so terrible. Like, no, it's okay. I don't mind. It's fine. I get it. I can't do it. Half an hour into the movie.
When we get the titles, half hour into the movie.
Which is a great choice.
Yeah.
30 minutes into the movie, the credits start. Because 30 minutes into the movie, the horror starts. And it's good. Now, I'm going to say this right now. We're going to have to talk a little bit about what happens here.
Yeah,
if you want to go
first,
into this movie as fresh as possible, you stop right now. We like this movie a lot. See this movie, know that it is gross. If, on the other hand, you don't mind us telling you the big plot point so we can talk about the movie... Continue. Yeah, we also have a time code in the description of the episode, so you can skip ahead to our review roundup if you just want to do that. So that's just your option there.
So yeah, Sebastian Stan suggests that they go on a vacation, like just the two of them, and it's a big step for them, like a romantic getaway with just the two of them. They go to this fancy house.
Yeah.
They have a nice dinner. She falls asleep,
uh-huh.
and she wakes up chained to the floor. On a little mat,
and she's like, "What's going on?"
And she's like, she's a little bit blindsided. What's happening?
And it's like, I drugged
you. And he says like the most chilling thing. Ooh, you're not gonna like what I'm gonna tell you.
I think his exact words are, "I'm gonna tell you, but you're gonna freak out.
You're gonna freak out." Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. And your initial thought is, "Oh, guys, this is some weird. What are we doing here?
Is this a Christian Grey thing?
What is going on? Like, how horrible is this gonna get?" And it turns out, what he does is he...
He runs a subscription box company.
Yeah, and his subscription box sells human meat. And in order to keep it fresh, he keeps people alive throughout the entire process.
As he butchers them.
So yes. He's going to keep her alive as he keeps cutting pieces off of her, cooking them, and sending them to people to eat.
Mm. And...
Oh, God! Yeah. The scene where we see him cook is... He's doing something amazing in that scene, but... Oh, God, is it disgusting. Like,
no, there's some gore, but it's not extreme.
It's not as bad as you'd think. Mm-hmm. It's just the context and how overt we're taking it.
Yeah.
And the idea that we know exactly what... And obviously it's fake, but, like, we see people consuming human meat. Mm. Obviously it's not, but, like, in the context of the film, it is... There's no shying away from it, and it's your skin just like wants to slide off of your bones. Like the skin's nope, walking away.
A conceit I love about most cannibal films. I've seen a lot of cannibal movies, and it's a conceit that's in Fresh as well. Is that there's something about human meat that just turns everybody into like this mad sensualist.
Like you can't. It's like a Lay's potato chip. You can't have just one.
Yeah,
like
that's a
once you pop, you can't stop.
And another conceit is if you eat it, you either become like super strong and intelligent,
like in the movie Ravenous,
or you eat it and you go insane, like in the movie The Road.
Well, and there is also like if you do eat like I don't know if it's the whole thing, but if you do eat human meat, there is actually like. An actual like brain problem you can develop, like it's an actual thing.
It's just you know what? It's just meat.
It's not quite, but like it's like we got mad cow disease. They were feeding cows other cows. That will lead to problems.
I suppose like, you know, so, but
you're not supposed to do that.
Well, humans are omnivores. We can eat each other. Healthily and safely.
We choose not to.
As that Ugandan soccer team, I find cannibalism to be like. A pretty funny taboo, the idea of like, oh,
what?
Because there's a really kind of humorous scene in Fresh where they're talking about eating meat and they're talking about the names of the people that those hunks of flesh once were.
Real fast, in the movie, I know you're thinking of the movie Alive, that soccer team,
Uruguayan. Sorry, I said Ugandan.
I was like, that can't be right.
I was a slip of the tongue, I apologize.
I see how you did it, for the sake of accuracy.
Two countries begin with U, I apologize.
There aren't that many, I totally get it.
It was Uruguayan, I knew it was Uruguayan, I said Ugandan, that was a slip of the tongue.
I'm not making a thing of it, just right. I thought of it and we can correct it now, rather than getting a letter about it later.
Sorry, apologies. Thank you for correcting me. I misspoke. But yeah, this idea that Frank is a sandwich now. that's kind of, something kind of silly about that to me.
There's a little bit
comedic element to that.
I'm reminded of a Monty Python sketch where a bunch of soldiers are trapped at sea.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, we all agree we're going to eat Roger. And Roger's like, fair enough. And one guy's like, well, I don't want to eat Roger. Well, why not? Rather eat Steve.
one of them is injured. It's like, I've got a gemmy leg. I'm going fast. You better eat me. It's like, oh, with a gemmy leg? Well, don't eat the leg. It's like, and then it's like, no, I can't do it. And he gets really offended. Why don't you want to eat me? Well, I'd rather eat Johnson, sir.
Well, like, there's a shocking number of cannibalism movies, if you think about it. And a weird number of them understand that the juxtaposition of the horror of killing somebody and eating them, or leaving them alive and eating them, and fine cuisine is a weird juxtaposition and we can get a lot of mileage out of it. There's an amazing, I think it's a Korean horror film called 301-302.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh my God, people do not know enough about this movie. It's fucking hilarious and terrifying. And it's all about a woman who fancies herself a master chef, who moves in next door to a woman who is phobic of food. The fact that I am bringing it up in the context of this right now should give you some sense of where that's going to go, but not entirely. Be warned, that movie is seriously fucked up, but good if you can handle that. Much like Fresh, which, getting back to the subject of Fresh. Fresh...
Yeah, I don't want to go too far into it, but I'll say that... Yeah. this is like a well-established system this guy has, these subscription boxes. So yeah,
it's a business. This isn't something he does for fun.
So the more the movie goes on, the more you realize how disturbingly structured all of this is and how many people are involved.
Once take something shocking or bizarre, whether it's the existence of ghosts or your cannibalism lunchbox delivery service, and once you turn it into a day job, you're always going to get something weird out of it.
Well, you're going to get something weird out of it. And I do, what I appreciate about Fresh is it takes this, you know, wild, sickening cannibalism concept and kind of follows it out to a logical conclusion.
It does.
Which I feel like a lot of horror movies or genre films that have an interesting concept don't always necessarily do.
Yeah, they don't. It feels like maybe they're holding something back for a sequel, or maybe they just...
Or they just didn't think it out all the way.
No, and here, like, often than not. Here, without, like, going to, like, some, you know, maybe the greatest extreme, which would be to sort of follow every single person who subscribes, this is a movie about, here's a woman who finds herself in this terrible situation, and she wants out. And in order to do that, she's got to make nice with her kidnapper, which puts her into increasingly gross situations. I'm surprised at how funny this movie is. This movie is partly because the cast is very funny, partly because the script is very witty and knows... The movie is shocking because the director knows when to make moments shocking. Mostly the movie is actually... The movie knows that it's a movie. It's never, like, looking at the camera and joking with you, but the movie knows when this is the scene that's going to gross you out and we need to build up to it with a musical number or something. Yeah, like, it's very, very much designed for an audience. I would kill to see this movie with a midnight audience.
Oh, golly, where everybody's sort of squirming.
Oh, yeah, this is going to be a great one for that.
And more than that, this is a wonderful woman's picture. Just about... The way women are so mistreated by, at the start, the dating system.
Just in general,
It's almost like set up to victimize women.
Yeah.
And how this whole, like, cannibalism is kind of an extension of
it's
that.
It's just a symptom of it. It's just one aspect of a world in which men view women as less than human, or at least less than them. And I will say this without going into more detail than we have to, it's not as bleak as you might think. You know, it's not gonna, you know, I wouldn't say it's like a yay happy movie or whatever like that, but this is a movie that knows you want to be entertained by this, and yet they're able to deal with serious issues in a way that doesn't feel like they're making fun of the inherent sociological horrors that led to the existence of a movie like Fresh.
Yeah,
but they also know that this is a movie about cannibalism, and that needs to be, forgive the pun, palatable. And in order to do that, they have made a very funny, very dark satire of dating through the use of cannibalism. And it works, and it is so damn good. And it is a really great horror movie. And this is not like good for straight to Hulu either, which I've said a couple of times.
This is a straight up great horror
movie. In any context.
Sebastian Stan deserves all the props in the world.
All of them.
For playing the kind of character who, A, you believe is really charming.
Yeah.
Convinces you that there's something a little off about him. And really, really gets you to hate him. So by the time there's, you know, certain violent things begin happening in the movie,
you're fine with it.
You're kind of okay.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, he deserves all of that. Yeah. It's a great performance. Like, seriously, like, the first third of this movie, I'm almost mad that it's going to be a horror movie because it's a good romantic comedy. And that's something that's...
But it has to be to sell
it has all the to extra be. Stuff. You need the extra time here because it can't just be she meets him and then runs away with him because you wouldn't believe that she'd do that. You have to believe that they have this connection. But here's the thing. Once the kidnapping starts... They still had that connection, and they're not going to pretend that that never happened, and their connection to each other is different between every other person who's ever kidnapped and done this to, and that's what the movie plays with in such a really interesting way.
There's a lot of great supporting characters as well, mysterious voices through the walls. There's a lesbian best friend who has a really great role. It's pretty tightly done. It is 2 hours, but
it doesn't feel it.
It's not one of those movies that is like kind of taking a lot of time to breathe. I think it's actually taking all that time to explore this premise properly. And not a minute wasted.
It's not like you're going to look at it like, oh, did that need to be that long? Or do we need a subplot? Like every single piece is here for a reason.
Yeah.
And it works. And it's another, again, this, I saw two amazing movies this week and one that was mixed bag. Let's review some movies. So here's our movie review roundup. Here's how it works if you're new. We review movies on Critically Acclaimed on a scale of C- to C+. The highest you can get is a C+. That's above average. Why? Because a C is average. A C is a mixed bag. It might be some good, might be some bad, might be just everything is just sort of medium. C plus is better than that. We genuinely recommend it. Maybe we think it's amazing. Maybe not. C minus is below average. And that's everything from we just generally don't particularly care for it to a genuinely terrible movie. Anything in that zone is a C minus. We do this because sometimes, and I think our Batman review qualifies, we might get so caught up talking about what's critical about a movie or maybe what we like about it that our overall takeaway can get a little lost. So, on the other hand, with something like Fresh, it's pretty straightforward. For example, Fresh is a C+ for me.
I give it a C+ as well.
Yeah.
I think it's a really wonderfully disturbing, just tight, wicked little Tales from the Crypt type
horror. Yeah, it's great. If you love Tales from the Crypt, you're going to love it, by the way. All right, let's see. Asking for It.
Asking for It is a C-. I started my review saying this is one of the worst of the year. It really is. It is badly made, really mishandled. It doesn't really know what it wants to say. It's bad. It's bad. That's a bummer. It's bad.
All right. After Yang is a gigantic C+.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely a potential candidate for the best movies of the year. Again, I don't like calling it that soon, but when it's this good, you have to think it's going to be there. Absolutely distinct, absorbing, thoughtful science fiction in a way that's incredibly gripping while being very quiet. And I really hope people see it because this is one of my favorite movies about the subjects it tackles, like artificial intelligence and stuff. Like, it's great.
Nice.
And then lastly, The Batman.
The Batman. I was unimpressed with The Batman. Mm. I feel like there's not a lot to be gained by watching The Batman. I understand Batman fans are going to watch it just because they like to compare versions.
Sure.
But I feel like, apart from that, this film doesn't have too much value. Mm. If you've seen Seven, you've seen the better version of this. If you've seen Zodiac, you've seen the much better version of this. there's not a lot that adding Batman to this kind of a movie is adding. And in fact, in making it about Batman, you're actually having to make it a little bit more audience friendly.
Mm.
So you're taking away a lot of the more daring details as a result of putting Batman in the movie. As such, it's just sort of pretty unsatisfying. So I'm going to give it a C-.
Okay. I liked it more than you did. Mm. I agree it's got problems. I think for a 3-hour epic, I think the story is plays it surprisingly safe once the mystery is revealed.
Yeah.
And I think that ends up feeling like a much ado about not a whole hell of a lot. But I do think it's fair to say that that the surface elements of this movie are strong enough that I enjoyed watching a lot of it. I think Zoe Kravitz in particular gets the meatiest role, and she's amazing in it. I really like the way it's shot. I think it's pretty daring to shoot a major motion picture of any kind in this striking and dark very distinct coverage choices. Got to give them a lot of credit for that, and I think they got away with it. There's a lot of design stuff that I think is really, really cool. And overall, it's longer than it needs to be, but I wasn't, like, checking my watch the whole time. I think it mostly fills out that sequence. I just feel that, ultimately, the story that it tells comes across as the style is attempting to elevate a pretty superficial story that doesn't lead somewhere as nearly as profound as the style would suggest.
Yeah.
And ultimately feels, at least from Batman's perspective, and he is the protagonist, a little surfacey and shallow. And that's kind of a waste of a 3-hour running time in a way. So again, surface level Batman stuff, good. Anything beyond that, anything that would make it like a great Batman movie, not there. So I'm going to give it a C.
All right.
Middle C, just boom. Some people are going to like this way more than others. I acknowledge that, but I think there are definitely issues with it that need to be addressed. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Next week, we will be back with reviews of the new Pixar film, Turning Red.
That's right.
But it's basically Teen Wolf, except they turn into a panda.
Instead of a wolf.
Yeah. And other things as well. We'll get to other things as well. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for showing up. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want more exclusive shows from us, you can head over to our Patreon. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a giant backlog of stuff, including all our yesterdays, where we review every single episode of Star Trek ever. We're already in the middle of season 2 of The Next Generation, so we've got an over 100 episode backlog already. So that's a lot of content just kicks in as soon as you sign up. We have Only the Best, where we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. That is another deep dive with a lot of episodes to catch up on if you're new. We have, for our Batman fans, Holy Batman, where we review every single episode of the 1960s Batman starring Adam West and Burt Ward. That has been an interesting journey. Mm. And we got a lot of episodes in the can for that as well. We do commentary tracks. We do hangouts every month. Big shout out. Very special thank you to all of our patrons without whom this show and all the others would not exist. And if you'd like to talk to us on anything we discussed in this episode, whether it's Batman, Fresh, you want to correct Whitney about something else, you can go ahead and email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail, so feel free to ask us questions or give us a prompt or anything else you want to talk about. And for those who prefer writing in, perhaps in a Riddler-esque manner, Whitney, what is our email? What is our P.O. Box? Sorry.
Address it to the Batman. P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah.
And write it in really scary handwriting.
Yeah, make sure it's legible, though, otherwise we won't get it. Thank you for that. Thank you. God damn it, we're gonna get the weirdest shit now. Okay, it's fine. So that's a thing. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WayneBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We just released some new soaps in our soap store. If you head on over to Salt Cat Soap, it's our Etsy store. You can look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word, or you can follow Salt Cat Soap on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. There'll be links to the store there. We have our Vampire Hours soap, which is a caffeinated soap, which is totally excellent. We also have some new relaxing massage bars. We have some bars where a percentage of the proceeds go to charity. We have a lot of stuff going on right now in that store. So thank you to everybody who has been buying the soap. We handcraft them, me and my partner, I'm Lopez and Silva. And the reviews have been really good. So the support means the world. So thank you for that. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you everybody once again for listening. And never forget, everyone is what?
The Batman.
The Batman.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?